Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 42. And this is with the Iconoclast. So, welcome to the channel, Dan from the Iconoclast.
Thanks for having me. I'm very privileged to be here with the vile vlogger himself. What an honor.
I still love that. I think it's so funny that the
Yeah, it's like you're a
vile.
rodent or something, you know. It's horrible, that word. It's just so, ugh.
Like Nosferatu. So
Yeah.
just some sort of creature that just wants to offend everyone and hurt them. It's ridiculous. I still don't think it was accurate. But anyway, we should be talking about your channel. So when did you start? Because your channel has grown very quickly.
Yeah, I started in January. Well, I uploaded my first video in January, but I kind of forgot about it. I didn't pay attention. I just did it because I was bored and I wanted to get something off my chest. It was some idiot Democrat in the United States. She was called Sally Boynton Brown. She was basically going on about how she wanted to win the DNC chair so she could shut down white people and the Democratic Party isn't for white people anymore and all that shite.
Yeah, I remember this. I recognize that name.
Yeah, I've no idea what she's doing now. She didn't win, obviously, but she just riled me up, so I did some like 10-minute commentary on it and I uploaded it and I forgot about it. I had no intention of starting a channel really. And then my mate, he said, "Dan, that video you uploaded like 3 weeks ago, it's got 500 views and you've got 30 subscribers." And I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" So I went on and yeah, and the reaction was positive, so I thought, I'll pick this up. I'll do a few more things and just took off from
That's
there,
great.
really.
So it's amazing how sometimes you just stumble on this. Like, I remember you said in one of your videos that you'd sort of drifted throughout your 20s and you didn't know what to do. And then suddenly you found yourself that this is something that you're good at and that you can care about and be engaged in. I think quite a lot of people end up it, like it, but they it, in your case it's really taken you by surprise.
Yeah, I think, well, I've always been, the last few years, I've always been an avid viewer of people on YouTube. I think it really kicked into gear during the Trump election season because I was just so bloody entertained by the whole thing. And my friend and I, we'd talk in real life at the pub and we'd be like, "Yeah, I'm totally for Trump now. Like, Trump's my guy." But we'd never say it in front of anybody else. You know, it was just our little thing. And he kept encouraging me to start the channel. And I thought, well, you know, I've got other things going on, you know, like you just said, I've tried a few different things over my 20s. It's never really stuck. I've failed at a lot of stuff. I was doing TV pilots in London. They never went anywhere. I was doing fucking wedding photography. That was a nightmare as well. So I was just doing all these things. And I thought one day, you know what? Why not? What am I going to lose? What have I got to lose? And here we are, I guess. Going strong.
And it's worked out. Yeah, it's worked out. I mean, I think you've got 45,000 now, something like that.
Things about
Can't remember what I
48,
looked at.
48,000. Yeah.
48 now, right? I mean, that's fantastic. So, I mean, how would you describe? Well, how would you describe the? I mean, I know that a lot of people who are watching this will have already they'll already be familiar with your channel, but to anyone who isn't, how would you describe the scope and the topics and the perspective in your channel?
I tried to keep it very Euro-focused because ultimately that's the area of the world that I live in. That's what I care about. The EU to me is just an endless source of, I mean, I don't even know what you can say about the EU at this point, but it's fucking ridiculous. So the EU's an always a constant source of content that I like to dive into. But I mean, obviously there's the Islam thing, but I mean, like we were talking before, we kind of get tired of talking about the same things over and over again, despite the fact that it's a very important topic, by the way, and we shouldn't
Oh
forget that.
yeah. Oh yeah, indeed. I mean, here's the thing. It's a very important thing to emphasize. For me, I have talked about Islam for 4 years, and sometime around the start of this year, I can't remember whether it was, I can't remember, but something happened and I thought, God, I just don't have anything to say about this. And I realized, God, I'm just bored talking about Islam. But the thing is, you can be bored by it. You can be no longer intellectually stimulated by it, but unfortunately, you can't escape it. This is going to be a very, very important part of our futures in Europe.
Yeah, and I think that there's this thing that exists is I call it the YouTube bubble, and those of us who make content regularly, we have to talk about things that we may not be that passionate about at that time. You know, Islam for me, I have to talk about it. And I think we all do because it's such a big issue. But my God, I don't know what else I can say about it at this point. But we can't let our personal boredom get in the way of this topic, because there are so many people who don't talk about this in real life that may stumble across our content and then find the voice, I guess.
Yeah, it's a sort of duty, to be honest. It's a sort of moral duty to talk about this, because it does enable other people. It gives them permission to talk about it, as the phrase goes.
And but you know, there's a whole host of that. But I'm just trying to build out my channel to be, first of all, accessible. I don't really go too deep that often. I just give my honest opinion on things and go through a few articles and because this is a journey for me as well. Like I said, I didn't plan on starting the channel, so I'm still figuring out where I stand on things, making up as I go along, to be honest. And I've made mistakes in previous videos that people keep bringing up to me and stuff, but it's a journey. And I'm not one of these guys that says he reads a lot of books about, you know, power politics, whatever hell it could be. And you know, I'm not really that deep on it, but I'm just a normal guy from the northeast of England, working class, and I just want to share my opinion, because, to be honest, I'm sick to the back teeth of everything right now.
How would you describe the? Because it seems to be naturally going in this direction that the mainstream media are not satisfying you, and probably a lot of people in your circle. That's the impression I get. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I did a video about the BBC, and I don't think you'll find anyone in this country who can say with a straight face that the BBC is impartial. I mean, that's just not possible. And by the way, yeah. I think the Corbyn fans actually have a point when they say that the BBC is unfair to Corbyn as well, because at the end of the day, and I don't like Corbyn, just putting that out there, but at the end of the day, the BBC is establishment through and through. And they want to preserve
What it tends to want is the status quo. And obviously, it tends to be the more liberal end of the status quo. But it's very unadventurous, frankly. And it always has been. I mean, even you know, in the 70s, this is a funny thing. One of the justifications for the BBC's existence tends to be, well, it can do things that commercial stations wouldn't tackle. But the truth is that if you look in the drama genre, because I'm quite familiar with 70s TV drama in Britain, the commercials on the ITV were more adventurous. They were more experimental. Whereas the BBC drama was very high quality. It was good, but it was very like meat and potatoes. And I think that goes really across the board in terms of the BBC's output. It is very, very mainstream, very establishment, very status quo. And, you know, so it doesn't actually fulfill its remit as, you know, it doesn't live up to the hype that it does things that commercial stations wouldn't tackle, and therefore we need it. So anyway, that's just my own bugbear.
I completely agree. I completely agree, and I think you just had On the Offensive on your channel before me, and I really like his content, and he did a really good video about the BBC, and he went through all of these old commercials that the BBC would put out, and they'd say, this is why you need to pay the license fee, because we have great drama and great nature shows and all this stuff.
Oh, God. The modern BBC drama is appalling.
I know, and well, I think this ad was like from the early 90s or something, but On the Offensive made a great point. He's like, well, if it's so great, then surely you can survive on the free market like every other channel, right? Why do we have to support it, you know, like with our money when we don't have a choice in the matter?
I mean, a more honest tagline would be something like, you've got to pay for this because it's a moral good, and it wouldn't, the marketplace wouldn't support it. So here's a sort of altruistic thing that we can do. I mean, I can understand that rationale. But if you're saying this just stuff is just so good, then it must survive in the marketplace, surely.
Exactly. And I do love Blue Planet and all those nature shows. I'm a big nature fan. I love animals and stuff. And they're great shows, but surely they can survive on ITV or Netflix, you know. I'm sure Netflix would snap it up. It would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this myth that we need the BBC, like it's essential for the BBC to exist for us to be British. It's just ridiculous. So
I think another aspect to it is that it was, and to some extent still is, just an institution, like a British institution. It's a core part of our culture. And I can understand, I can definitely understand the affection that people have for it, because I, you know, I kind of have it myself, this nostalgia about the BBC. I think that in the, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it must have been a real nice time to work at the BBC in Television Centre when it was all gleaming new and it was just this factory endlessly producing more and more material. That must have been a fun time. But as an institution, I think it's had its day. And I think it's also never lived up to its own hype. And I think it's basically immoral. I think it's immoral to tax people. You know, if you own a TV, you've got to pay for the BBC, whether you like it or not. That I don't know if that flew ever, but I certainly don't think it flies now.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about the TV license is you can... I've got a few American friends, and they didn't know what the TV license was. So when I explained it to them, they were horrified. They were like, what, the government forces you to pay for the TV? What? This is crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is crazy. And of course, it leads to this dreadful... I mean, there's a whole class of people in British society who work for the BBC, and they live in this bubble where they're not subject to market forces, but also they're just so insulated from normal people that they can believe whatever they like. I mean, this is the sort of the heartland of champagne socialist Britain.
Exactly, and I actually have a bit of personal experience with the BBC. When I was in university, I entered this competition. It was a script writing competition, and I wrote a script for a TV series, and the BBC really liked it, and they invited me down to the studios in Salford in Manchester, and I had a meeting with some producers, and they were like, Dan, this is, you know, we really like your stuff. We're going to put you on this writer's mentoring program. You'll come down to the BBC every now and then, every couple of months, and we'll see what you've written. We'll give you tips and all that stuff. And I mean, it never went anywhere, but the point is, I spent a bit of time in the BBC studios, and you want to talk about diversity as our strength. I mean, they should have that printed on the bloody walls at that place, because every single employee, or most of them, were from either an ethnic minority background, or they were gay, or whatever, or they had purple hair.
God.
You know? Yeah, it was. I've read that the BBC is overrepresented in those demographics. Like, it's actually underrepresented in white men specifically, because, you know, they just bar them from applying for certain positions. But yeah, I mean, the BBC, I could go on all day. I'm sure everyone else could as well.
Yeah, it is an interesting topic. I nearly gave a speech on it in May this year, but I decided against it in the end. But I will at some point make a nice sort of in-depth thing about it. I mean, I was upset. Well, not upset. I was depressed when they moved from Television Centre to Salford, simply because it's 50 years of... I mean, it was a totally unnecessary move. It cost them a fortune, and it ended this 50-year thing. And I just don't understand. Apparently, it was all motivated by... It's sort of guilt about being London-centric, so they just had to make this move. And I mean, I guess they're now Salford-centric. I suppose that's the new thing, and it's okay because Salford is, you know, a largely working-class area. But, I mean, I would bet money that even then they're still insulated from the surrounding area, because it'll be, you know, Media City will be its own thing. It'll be its own microcosm, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, Media City as just a place. You look at the architecture, you look at this new huge BBC studio and all the offices and stuff, and it's garbage modern architecture. I mean, you can imagine what it looks like. It's just glass everywhere, and there's fucking, you know, bright colors and spotlights shining around and fake trees and all this stuff. You don't realize that you're actually in Salford in Manchester. It looks nothing like a working class surrounding. And yeah, I think they've kind of tricked everyone with that, because on the surface, it did look like, well, we're going to have more representation in the north, but actually, we're going to be more postmodern, and more stuck in our ideology than we've ever been, and this building proves it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose that gets us to the thing that I wanted to ask you about, because we were talking before we went on air about your sort of political journey, as it were, and you were talking about Paris.
Yes.
Well, when I first discovered your channel, I think that was in, I think it was March or April, sometime around then. And I could tell, you know, various things about your, you know, your political perspective, your position. But it seemed very much that you were a civic nationalist and you didn't care about, you know, race. And I know that, that this is a sort of journey that you're on. So why don't you tell people about Paris?
Yeah, okay. So I did a video about this. In 2015, January 2015, I took a trip to Paris just by myself because I wanted to get away for a while, needed a break. You know, things in my life at that time were a little stressful. I'd probably just come off my most recent failure, whatever it was at the time. And for a few days, just to relax, to chill. First day I was there, and I went into the main train station in Paris. I don't know what it's called, but I got off the plane at the airport and got the train into the city. And honestly, if you told me I was in Zimbabwe, I would have believed you. And I tried to deny it. I was only 24 at this point, so I was still quite young. I tried to deny it. I tried to say, oh, you know, it's a European, you know, it's a big capital city in Europe. There's lots of people coming in from all sorts of places, going to all sorts of different places as well. And, you know, of course there's people from all over the world in this train station, but walking around the streets of Paris after that, very much the same, very, very much this gut feeling of this doesn't feel right to me. This is very off-putting. I don't like it. I don't feel like I'm in Paris. It's the same sort of feeling when I go to London, when you're not in central London, of course. And yeah, people always criticize me for this video because I made a mistake. I said, even the hotel I stayed in wasn't owned by a French person. It was an Arab guy. I think he was Turkish. And obviously I know now, you know, Turkish people aren't Arabs. It was a silly mistake. But
yeah,
everyone,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I didn't write a script for the video. I just said it off the cuff. But everyone who criticizes me.
It's an easy mistake to make. I mean, it's the same with Pakistanis. Pakistanis are not Arabs. And apparently they get really pissed off if you call them Arabs. I mean, it's just an easy thing. You know, in our heads, they're all Arabs. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, ignorance.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I owned up to the mistake pretty quickly. I put it in the description. I said, yes, I realize Turks aren't Arabs, all that stuff. But the people who had criticized me for that video, where I'm basically complaining about the demographics of Paris and how uneasy it made me feel, they would only pick on that point. They would say, Turks aren't Arabs, you idiot. And that would be the end of the criticism. It's like, well, that doesn't address anything else that I said. It's still the same point, isn't it?
Yeah. It so it's like, yeah, it's like they're discrediting you and dismissing everything else you said just on the basis of that, you know, trivial mistake. That's ridiculous. But one thing I am interested in, why did it make you feel uneasy in Paris? Was it because you have a mental image of, I mean, you know, Paris is a city that we're supposed to feel romantic about it. You know, it's supposed to be the city of lights and, you know, there are many mental images that one associates with Paris. And then, but when you go to Paris in this day and age, it does not match that. And of course, it's true. It's true of most European cities now that I've been to. They are not, and this is a transformation that I think has occurred over the last 15 years. It's like 10 to 15 years. And they are not what you think they are going to be. So there's that. There's that aspect to it, which I think, and especially in Paris, I haven't been to Paris for 15 years, so I don't know what it's like now, but I've heard all these things. So there's that thing that would make you feel uneasy, I could guess. And then the other thing is simply the presence of large numbers of non-whites, which you get into the in-group preference thing then. So tell me about that. I mean, why do you think you felt uneasy there?
Well, I think the romanticism element did come into play, but, you know, I think everyone understands that the Paris you see on TV isn't really what it was ever like. I mean, it's the same with everywhere, but you would expect to see something that resembles just a little bit of that. So that was
something
definitely
redolent of that.
Yeah, so that was definitely a part of it. But I think you talk about in-group preferences, and I completely believe in in-group preferences. And yeah, I didn't feel comfortable there. And I was there by myself. It's not like I was there with a group of friends and we were just going to, you know, go to bars for the weekend or something, you know. I was there by myself. I was there to have a relaxing time. And instead, I felt very threatened, and I didn't feel like I was in a familiar place. You know, because Western Europe, there's cultural differences, of course, but you feel, you should feel at home in all of these places because there's a brotherhood among Western Europeans. And
it's our civilization.
Exactly.
It's ours.
Yeah, and I didn't feel that in Paris. I felt very exposed, I guess. And I guess that culminated at the end of my trip when I was essentially robbed by a bunch of African migrants. So they weren't violent. They basically surrounded me and, you know, made threats and kind of forced me out of some money for some shitty little string bracelet that they cooked up. it was terrible. And another thing that happened when I was there that just added to this whole feeling, it compounded it, was the second day I was there, the Charlie Hebdo attack happened, and it was just chaos. You know, there was...
Oh, wow. Right, yeah. Okay, so yeah, of course, because it was January 2015 then, yeah.
Yeah, so already I was feeling, you know, uncomfortable about the demographic situation, and then I was at the Eiffel Tower taking pictures like a typical tourist, and then I see people running around scared, like rushing around, talking on their mobile phones to family members in raised voices, and I see all these military-style police vans driving around really quickly and guys with machine guns, and I just thought, what is happening here? I didn't realize what had happened until I got back to my hotel room that afternoon. I'm like, oh wow, that kind of passed me by. And the rest of that week was just stress, complete stress. So, yeah, that experience was very eye-opening for me. And I guess I've had that in my mind ever since. And when I started my channel, that story just kept coming to the forefront of my brain, and when I eventually made a video about it, it kind of helped me put things into perspective a little more, which led to my most recent video about actual demographics.
So that was the video that you put out about, was that a week ago now, something like that?
Yes.
And I watched it, and I had it on watch later for quite a while because it's quite a substantial video. It's like 55 minutes long, yeah. But I was thinking, He's changed from a civic nationalist to some kind of ethno-nationalist. And because the thrust of that video is that a people, an ethnic group, is being, if not replaced in its homeland, then outnumbered in its homeland. And that, you know, to even care about that, you know, I mean, the standard civic nationalist response to that would be, well, it doesn't matter, because as long as they, you know, they speak English and they share our values, even though no one knows what those values are, then it's fine, you know. Whereas to actually care about the very people themselves, like the genetic ancestral group themselves, that is, you know, that's another thing entirely. It's some people would say it's racist, but of course they never say that about the Japanese or any other group. It's only when you have concern for the continuation of a white ethnic group, then you're racist. So of course it's a very difficult jump for a lot of people to make.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Japan there. Japan is the greatest example that we can use to deflect that, because it's a non-white society. It's essentially, I mean, it's 98% Japanese, native Japanese. And I don't think you'd find even the most hardened multiculturalist here in Britain, some champagne socialist twat like Bob Geldof, I don't think even he would ever condone mass immigration into Japan to water down Japanese culture. You know, in my video, I used an example of like, well, what if millions of white Europeans went to Japan and started changing the culture to best fit them? You know, why isn't there enough Western European representation on television for me? I feel alienated in the society. Like, no one would go for that. It's only Western European societies, white societies that have to deal with this. And you talk about British values. I started the video by saying, what is British culture? What are British values? Because I was asking myself that question for a long time. And on the British values question, I can't give you an answer. I really can't. And if you listen, I really can't anymore. It's been diluted so much.
Yeah, I think that when the Westminster attack happened, which I think was March or April, or was it May this year, sometime around then, I did a video on it, and Theresa May had given a speech about it and said that these attacks are an assault on our British values. And then she listed some. So when I did this video, I remarked on each one. And of course, there are several problems with reducing our nation to values. And one of them is that the values change. Nobody shares them all anyway. And that the same values crop up in other societies. Often the entire set of values that you name would also be named by a politician in another country. So it's stuff like belief in fair play, which I think is hilarious. You know, it's like, you know, those people over there believe in cheating. Their national value is cheating. Oh, dear. You know, and that's how we distinguish ourselves from them, you know, because we believe in fair play. And then another one would be tolerance. Well, you know, first of all, what they mean by tolerance is not really tolerant, and it's definitely not something that our grandparents would have believed in. But second, the alternative to believing in tolerance is to believe in intolerance, and very few people would actually say, yeah, I think we should be intolerant. But that's just ridiculous. But then the other thing is, of course, in France and Germany and Sweden, they believe in tolerance as well. So you can't say that that's, I mean, you can't say that those are specifically British values. And so this is the problem. You know, when you try to define a nation and a people by the values that they believe in, I don't think it works. I don't think it works at all. And then, of course, there's the other part of this, that at least I've still got my constitution, which is that, well, okay, let's say the entire population were replaced by people who also believed the same values. Does that mean that nothing has changed? Surely not.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's obvious to me that a country is defined by its people. And, you know, British values... Listen, if white Brits become a minority in this country and some other group replace them, the values are going to change. I mean, let's say if the Islamic community, those jolly fellows, if they became the minority, which it looks certain that they're going to be if nothing's done, that's what all the predictions are showing. In 200 years, will Britain still be the Western liberal democracy it is today? No, it won't. The values will change to suit the majority group's preferences. That's simple stuff. And I don't understand why it's controversial to recognize that. You know, I mean, of course, if you say that on a BBC television show, they'll be like, how dare you? How dare you say that? I don't know. It's common sense. Clearly, it's common sense. I did a video.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Their own ancestral culture will eventually assert itself. It will try to reconquer them, its wayward children. And then they'll start, they'll just recreate their ancestral culture. They'll recreate their ancestral nation. Why would they not do that? You know, it's human nature.
Yeah, I did a video about, this was ages ago, this was like whenever the Dutch election was on, because I was interested in Geert Wilders. I thought it was very exciting that he was doing so well in the polls over there and stuff. And I did a video about the results of that Dutch election. And he came second, which none of us expected him to win, but he did better than expected. But the thing that really stood out to me was there's a small party, a new party in the Netherlands called DENK, D-E-N-K. And this party has been set up by people who define themselves as Turkish Dutch, right? And their political manifesto is, they say they're a movement for migrants and a tolerant and solidarity society, which, among other things, calls for a racism registry. And this small party won 3 seats in the national Dutch election. And I'm thinking, you know, that this is only going to happen across Europe when demographics increase of these groups. And you can have political parties that can set the agenda, that can set policies. And if you think that Europe's going to always be Europe when this is going on, then you're deluded, absolutely deluded.
Yeah, the similar things happen in Germany and in Britain as well. For now, the sort of colonized the Labour Party. Or it'd be more fair to say that the Labour Party appeases them all the time. But eventually they will have their own party. The Respect Party existed for a while, but it seems to have gone defunct. I don't think its time had come. But eventually there will be an Islamic party. Of course there will be. And the same thing happens in Germany as well. because they have a huge Turkish population. And I can't remember the numbers now. But of course, what will happen then is that they will simply vote in blocks. I mean, this is how the Labour Party can be. This is why they want so many Pakistanis in Britain, because they reliably vote for Labour. And well, and there are ideological reasons for the Labour Party to want this. I mean, to rub the knight's nose in diversity and change Britain forever. I mean, it's just incredible. It's just, you know, when you hear that language and you realise the implications, that this political party is literally taking it upon itself to redesign the population of this ancient country. You know, that is the hubris, the arrogance of that is mind-boggling. They talk about nations like they're just canvases upon which, you know, anything can be drawn. And you don't have to be limited by, well, anything. You know, you can just do it. You can just bring the people in the sufficient numbers to have the effect that you desire. This gets us into the sort of Soros side of things, where you just re-engineer entire sections of the world according to your designs. But anyway, so yeah, these parties in the meantime exist because there are large numbers of people who want them. They want a political voice, and they want a political voice because they see themselves as a distinct people with distinct needs. So, well, the issue, I guess, is how can we stop them from feeling that way? And would it be humane to stop them feeling that way? Because essentially it'd be like giving them a lobotomy, like taking away their identity.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because you're right. They're going to feel that way no matter what, because people want to be represented by people who will empathize with them, and they'll represent them the best they can, which, you know, comes back to in-group preferences. But just touching on the Labour Party, I live in a Labour stronghold, essentially. Every election, everyone up here, very working class, they vote the Labour Party no matter what. And this past election, I kept hearing people say, well, you know, I don't like Corbyn that much, but I'm going to vote Labour because I always vote Labour. My dad voted Labour, my granddad voted Labour. And I love the people here. Yeah, I love the people up here, but I want to give them a fucking slap sometimes, because they need to break out of this cycle. Working class people are mass immigration destroys the working class. It really does. And yet they're voting for a party that pretends to care about them, but really their main concern is with the immigrants coming to this country. I mean, nobody can deny that about the Labour Party right now. They are so anti-British working class, it's unbelievable. Yet
just look at London. Just look at London. You know, I was talking about this with On the Offensive. I don't know how many communities throughout London, white working class communities, that once existed and had existed for probably centuries, they don't exist now. They're gone. You know, it's all been dissolved.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to happen up here as well. The northeast of England has been relatively lucky so far in terms of the demographics issue, but even over this past year, I've noticed some significant changes. Just the other day, I live in a very small town. It's kind of an in-between town in the region, between a few cities. Majority white, of course, but yesterday I was waiting at the bus stop. I was going to meet a mate in Durham for a few drinks. And as I was waiting at the bus stop, three fully, you know, cloaked Muslim women with the whole shebang, the letterbox thing that they wear, right? The whole shebang. Three of them walking in a row with pushchairs with babies in. And I'd never seen this before in my town. It was out of nowhere. Out of nowhere. The majority of people in my town are elderly, retired. It's that sort of place. And seeing this image was just, oh, it started here. It's coming here now. And I'm surprised it took this long.
Yeah, so many towns in the north of England have been effectively colonized by Muslims. I mean, all these ex-industrial mill towns are just gone. It's something that I think it's happened over the last 50 years. I don't know when I don't really know when it started. I don't really know why it started either, because it doesn't make sense for them to go there. But I guess it does in a way, because you can take over an area like that demographically more easily than you can take over a city. So there are lots of these little towns that are now basically Islamic. And there is no one city in England or Britain that's basically Islamic. Not yet. Birmingham, Luton, I guess you could say at Leicester, yeah, they're on the way. As far as I know, they're not there yet. But lots of little towns have just gone. They're not British, they're not white English city towns anymore. Those communities, again, have just been dissolved and dispersed, and they don't exist now.
Yeah, especially my town. I mean, it's the sort of town where young people do not come to this town to live. They leave, right? And the people who are left here grow old and die here. Am I still young at 27? I still feel, yeah, I guess I am.
Yeah, you are. You are.
Not for much longer, I don't think. But honestly, there's hardly any people my age around here. It's me, my best friend, and, you know, you see a couple of other people here and there, but majority of the people here are going to die here. They're very elderly, and it's going to be very, very easy to replace the population of a town like this and a smattering of other towns across the north of England. And the northeast has escaped it so far, but it's coming here next. And I don't know, it's hard not to get really depressed about this, but I guess we can get into some solutions a little later. I'm sure you've got some ideas about it. I'm still coping with a shell shock, to be honest.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I want to be completely honest and upfront about this. For me, it is a cultural issue and a religious issue, but it is also a racial issue or an ethnic issue. I wouldn't care if they, I mean, you know, and this, again, it's a very important to emphasize, I don't hate them just because they're a different ethnic group or whatever. It's got nothing to do with that at all. I am motivated by love for my own people. And also just the fact that these are ancient things. You know, like each of those towns that has now become Islamic in the last few decades probably had hundreds of years before that, or even thousands of years before that, when it was white English. And so I just think, you know, even if you didn't care about the ethnic groups, surely you would care about the continuity of history. But, you know, that's another thing, I guess. For me, an ethnic group has value in and of itself, especially when it's mine or related, similar to mine. I care about them. And, you know, if a Muslim woman, you know, takes off her veil and becomes westernized, I think, oh, that's nice, but she's still not one of my people. And that doesn't mean that I hate her. It just means she's still not one of my people. And I still want a white woman, a white English woman, to be there. This is the issue for me. And the cultural and religious stuff is also very important, because God knows it's going to have huge ramifications for us all in the next few decades. But that is where I come from on this. It's a sort of instinctual awareness of an ethnic reality, or of what I consider a reality. And I would also say, since this links with your own video about this, this is an instinct that is natural all across the world and all throughout the animal kingdom. So it's not something that we should feel guilty about. It's simply a desire for your own kind to continue existing. And, you know, you might have complicated feelings about your people. I do. I think, you know, most human groups are pretty complex entities. So it's not like you just love them or you just think they're marvelous, but they are yours. So why would you not care for them? And, you know, that's the perspective that I'm coming from here. Now, I mean, what would you say about all of that?
I think it's a very natural thing to feel. And the funny thing is, you just brought up the animal kingdom there. And I don't want to come in with an animal analogy, because I know that's stupid. But, like, you know, I was reading the other day about these orangutans in Asia somewhere. I'm not sure where. And they're on the endangered species list. They're about to go extinct. There's only a few hundred of them left in the wild. And it's due to deforestation, i.e. their home has been taken away from them. They've got nowhere to live anymore. They're dying off. And you will have... so many people who were, if you told them about that, they'd be like, oh my God, we've got to save these orangutans. Got to do it. Deforestation's terrible. We're taking their homeland away from them, damn it. And yet they don't realize, or they choose to ignore, that it's happening just on a human level in their own country. And it's like, I don't know what it is. It's some mental block. Maybe it just hasn't been explained to them fully yet. But I truly do believe that deep down, everyone's going to come around to this. I'm not saying everyone's going to join the alt-right, but everyone has this natural inclination to protect their own group. I genuinely think I agree
with you. And I think by the time that the majority come around to these ideas, it won't be called the alt-right anymore. And these ideas won't be called alt-right ideas, because the alt-right doesn't own these ideas. These ideas are eternal. And I think they will just go mainstream. I think that there is, and other people have said this in this millennial season, at least two other people have echoed the sentiment that there is a sort of change coming that is so big that right now we aren't even, it's difficult to fathom it, because it's going to come as a result of so many simultaneous forces that it's just so huge that you can't really predict it. Everything just now seems like it's just going along as normal as it has done for the last few decades, but there is something under the surface moving, and that it's going to erupt. And I think it will erupt sometime in the next 10 years. And I think that suddenly a lot of lies are going to be discarded. A lot of people are going to be shamed and embarrassed. And I think there'll be huge turmoil in European societies. I'm not looking forward to it, but I think it's kind of inevitable. You can't do this amount of drastic remixing of a population and expect it to go smoothly. You know, what's going on right now is that huge amounts of effort are going into suppressing the natural reactions to that sort of change. Huge amounts of money are being spent on, you know, programming the young to welcome and embrace diversity. But at some point it's going to dawn on millions of white people that diversity means fewer of them, and that each of them has less of a hold on their society than they would have had, and that each of them has less of a chance to reproduce with one of their own kind than they would have had, and that each of them has to deal with 10, 20 things every single day that they wouldn't have to deal with if they lived in a homogenous society, and that fundamentally they're looking at the end of their kind. And, you know, that is a massive realization. And I think it's very difficult for an individual to make those realizations. It tends to take several years for an adult to understand the enormity of that. I think that when a society, when a large number of people make those realizations, it could turn nasty, you know, very fast, because they will reinforce each other's shock, each other's outrage. And I suspect this is why I think the powers that be desperately want to stave off this reaction, this realization, for as long as possible, because they know that when it erupts, they will have no way to control it. That's what I think is going on here at this stage. I think the government and so on have just, for whatever reasons, and everyone has different explanations for this, but for whatever reasons, the governments of the West have fomented this situation, they've let it develop, and they've boxed themselves into a corner, and now they have no idea what to do about it.
Yeah, I think your analogy there about Europe, Western Europe being kind of like a dormant volcano that's just ready to explode again is correct. I tend to agree. I think it's unavoidable at this point that it's going to devolve into complete madness. And I mean, like you said, I don't want that to happen, but I can't see it. I can't see it being avoided at this point, because there is literally no one in British politics, or especially British politics, that is coming out and talking about this issue and saying this is a big problem, we have to address it. Nobody's doing it. No one. And I think you're right. When people realize that they've been lied to all this time, then it's going to make the situation much worse. And I wanted to talk to you about this because I feel it's a problem with the youth and young people having nihilism pushed on them, because they really don't seem to care about much. And deep down, I think they do care, but they've just been told that they shouldn't, or that it's not worth caring about. That you just live life for the bloody moment, man, you know? And I think that's a big problem.
I think this is related to being detached from your ancestors and caring about your descendants. I think it's fundamentally the same thing, because if you are detached from those things, from your past and your future, then your present becomes somewhat meaningless. You know, it's really just a matter of what distractions, what sensations you can fill in, you can squeeze into your present day. But those are always going to be kind of silly. They're always going to be kind of trivial. I think that most people do have an instinctual desire to belong to a long-term story that eclipses them, because that puts them in a context. It gives their life, well, meaning. And I think that as we were saying earlier, I think that there is tremendous effort going into making people not feel attached to their ancestors and not care about their descendants. And that's a very typical attitude now. You get people who are very intelligent, very well educated, spouting these ideas that, well, we're all individuals and we should not be shackled by our ancestors, and we should not be thinking about what will follow us when we die, because that's not our business. You know, we can't shackle our descendants, so stop worrying about it. But unfortunately, I think the effect that that has on an individual is a depressing effect and a demoralizing effect. It's not surprising at all that so many people are on antidepressants nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually talking to my girlfriend about this. She takes an interest in my channel. She doesn't watch everything I do, but she knows I do it. And she said, "What's your new video about?" And I said, it's about demographics, the dwindling white British demographics. And I told her about the certain section of the video where I'm talking about, you know, young millennial women especially have been persuaded to not have children, or they've been told.
Yeah, and that's so disturbing. It's so horrible.
Yeah, the reasons are always shallow and superficial. I mean, I guess it sums up our modern society, but it's always like, you know, if you don't have kids, you can have more money to get wasted with on the weekend. Woohoo, you know? And it's like, but what about legacy? What about passing something down? What about leaving the world in a better place than what you found it for someone else? You know, why is it
what about when you're 40 or you're 50 and you don't want to go out every weekend and get drunk? You know, it's even that. It's so short term. It's not even taking into account what's going to happen in your own lifetime. This is a big thing. You know, I think a lot of people, a lot of these career girls now who are in their 20s and 30s, what are they going to be like when they're in their 50s and 60s? I mean, I know that there's nothing that we can really do for them. They just have to, it's too late for them, you know? Well, most of them. But I do nonetheless feel it's going to be awful for them. You know, when it dawns on them, holy shit, I'm never going to be a mother. I'm never going to be a grandmother. There are never going to be grandchildren in my house. You know, that is going to be absolutely devastating for a lot of women.
Yeah, and it's glamorized as well. I can't tell you how many girls I've known in my life who they say it in a jokey way, but there's an element of sincerity about it. They say, "Oh, I'm going to be one of those crazy cat ladies when I'm older," and I think, "Yeah, you will, you will." And you're saying it in a jokey way, but it's the absolute truth, and you don't even realize it. You don't realize how bad that is, and it's across the board. It's very, very depressing. Thankfully, my girlfriend calls bullshit and all that, and you know, I see a really nice future for the pair of us. But it's a real shame. It's a real shame, and it bleeds into pop culture as well. I know a lot of people are talking about Star Wars, but that's a very, very nihilistic film, the new one. And it completely severs the idea of legacy and leaving something behind for the next generation. I know I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll get hold of it somehow. I don't know if I'll go to the cinema for it. It seems a bit much. not after The Force Awakens.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to go on too much about it, but it's a massive part of the audience dislikes the film. And I was reading through some of the reviews on YouTube and watching some reviews on YouTube from just regular people who have seen the film. They want to talk about it. And their criticisms don't just focus on, you know, regular film critique. It's like, well, the writing was bad here and the lighting, all that sort of stuff. It goes deeper than that. It's like the legacy. Star Wars is about family and passing things down in the next generation. Yeah. And there's nothing that.
Dynasty. So I think,
yeah. And I think a lot of people are starting to get that about society now. And people are seeing through. I mean, Disney just bought a massive chunk of Fox and they're going to own the majority of movie properties in Hollywood, I think. And if they're going to put this sort of messaging in these films, then I think it could actually be turned into a big unintended red pill for a lot of people, which kind of makes the film good. I don't know. What does that mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, I will watch it and deliver some sort of critique on it in January or February. And the same with the new Star Trek series Discovery, because I'm really fascinated to see those first two episodes, because the stuff I've heard about it, it makes it sound really, well, you know, to go boldly where no SJW has gone before, sort of thing. It seems to really raise the bar in terms of progressivism, and I'm very interested to see it for that reason. But yeah, in the meantime, no, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the Star Trek one either. Star Wars, the Last Jedi. But yeah, I've watched several video reviews of it on YouTube, and there does seem to be this running theme is that it destroys the idea of legacy, and as you say, that has been a crucial part of Star Wars, because it's been a crucial part of Western mythology and really all mythology. I mean, all mythology is about things being passed down through time. That is what it's all about, and it's amazing to see that being deconstructed in real time by popular culture. But again, this does bring us back to the malady of our times, which is that people are no longer rooted in history. So they do just have the present moment and the distractions of the present moment. And that in turn, that feeds off and feeds the separation from their people as well, their ethnic group or whatever, their race. So it's definitely something that I think will have to be dealt with one way or the other. Now, you were asking earlier on about solutions to this. I do think that we're going to have to reverse this change as much as possible, because Europe is our homeland. And I don't know. I mean, one thing is, I do think that there's going to be civil unrest because of Islam. It would be entirely different if Islam were not an element in the mix. I think that Islam is, and as I've said before, they could take over peacefully. You know, they could just outbreed us. But I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think, for whatever reason, they don't have the sense, they don't have the gumption to just do that. So I think there's going to be war in Europe. I think there's going to be civil war. I don't think it will be constant and, you know, omnipresent, you know, all over the continent at once. But I think it will become just a normal thing. And I mean, right now you can see that with the terror attacks. It used to be that after each terror attack, politicians would from all over Europe would fly to the city where it happened and they'd hold some sort of vigil, but they don't even bother doing that now. They don't even bother, you know, they don't even bother singing Imagine or whatever that they used to do. It's all become just normal. And this is a very disturbing thing, because you don't want to get used to terror, you know, to terror attacks. But I think it has happened. And I think they are increasingly just don't know what to say. After these things happen, they've got the list of platitudes about our values and an assault on democracy. And now more than ever, it's important that we don't give in to hate, that kind of stuff. But everyone knows that that doesn't get us anywhere, because there will be another terror attack and another one and another one. So, and it's the same with the Christmas markets. You know, this. I was going to do a video about this with the diversity barriers. It's never going to end. You know, this is not something that, oh, we've got to have these diversity barriers for the next 2 years or the next 5 years or even the next 10 years. This is forever now, until either we get rid of them, from Europe, or they take us over and there aren't any more Christmas markets. You know, it's the enormity of that is quite mind-boggling.
Yeah, I am. Speaking of diversity barriers, I was actually at the Newcastle Christmas market last week or something, and they're really hard to miss. I mean, the huge, colourful blocks, and I went up to one, I started touching it, and I realised it was actually a massive tank full of water surrounded by a steel cage, which I found oddly interesting for some reason. But nobody does anything. Nobody says anything. One of the most depressing things I've seen was during the summer, my hometown, Sunderland, they do an annual air show, and it's really impressive. They have all these really cool jets fly over and stuff. And my girlfriend and I went, but of course there was armed police there with massive, you know, guns. And there was snipers on the roof and stuff with binoculars. It was crazy. And
wow.
Yeah, it was. I did a video about it. But the thing that really depressed me was kids were getting their pictures taken with these armed police and their parents, obviously, because if you're a little boy and you see a guy with a massive gun, you're like, well, I want to see that. I want to get my picture taken with that. And the parents were indulging them, and the big smiles, thumbs up, this kid's getting his picture taken with two heavily armed police officers. And I was just thinking, you know, when you take your child home, are you going to tell him why those cops are there, why they need to be there?
Because Labour needed more votes.
Yeah, you're gonna and they probably voted Labour as well, to be fair. Yeah, but that kid and all these other kids are going to grow up in a society where that's just seen as the norm, and their parents aren't going to tell them exactly why that is. And I just found that on a really enjoyable day, and it was an enjoyable day, I don't know, that thought really stuck with me. And what can you do? I don't get too depressed about this, but
no, you know, I know it, but it is it's a strange thing to realize, isn't it, that those kids don't know that once upon a time there wouldn't have been that policeman with that big gun. You know, yeah. He wouldn't have been needed. I mean, you see it all over in the big cities. The police now look like soldiers, whereas once upon a time it was, you know, the bobby on the beat who was very polite and all that. you know, it's just like it's an amazing contrast. Yeah, but to get to the thing about solutions, I think that we should incentivize them to leave voluntarily. And I don't think it will be easy, because this is not something... There's a reason why they came here, and the reason is fundamentally that their own countries, or ancestral countries, are not as nice as our countries. So it's very difficult to persuade... It's going to be very difficult to persuade them to go back to those ancestral countries. But I think that we're going to have to do it one way or another. And, you know, there is the thing with, as I said, with Islam. I think, I don't know how bad that's going to get, but I think it would be a big mistake to think that because we haven't had war in Europe for 70 years, that war is an impossibility in Europe, because it's just not. You know, all these flashy, you know, steel and glass buildings, they can be bombed into rubble. And, you know, all these systems that we have, all these structures that we've built, they can be destroyed. You know, they can be starved of resources and staff, and everything can fall apart. And, again, I don't want to be too depressing, because it's, you know, it's Christmas is coming and all that. But this is what we're dealing with. And I think that people know it, actually. I think that most people know it. And it's an insult when the politicians pretend otherwise. And I think that's why the politicians have stopped overtly pretending otherwise. They do it less often now, you know, unless they absolutely have to say something about multiculturalism and diversity, then they increasingly don't say something, because they know it's all a load of lies, and that everyone else knows it's a load of lies. So, to cut a long story short, I think that there's going to be war with Islam. And I think that when that starts, or when it's heating up, I think that a lot of non-whites will leave of their own accord, because they'll just think, okay, this isn't our battle. We don't need to be involved in this. Let's go back to where it's safe. even if we've never been there before, even if grandpa came over here 50 years ago, let's just go back there. Because it's ultimately, I think a lot of them will see it as, well, Whitey did this. Whitey set this up for himself, so let him deal with it. That would be a very human understanding of the situation. And of course, there will be some who do stick by us. I know that, and I'm not pretending otherwise. I'm not pretending that they're all just going to piss off. I don't think that would happen. But I think that what will come out as a result of this, and I don't know how long it will all take, all this upheaval, but I think what will come out of it will be a renewed understanding of our race, of our peoplehood, and of our sovereignty, and of time, our place in time, what we owe to the past and what we owe to the future. So I think it might be something that just has to happen. We have to learn the hard way, because God knows we've had it easy for so long. I mean, that's part of how this was able to come about in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, is I've been thinking about this for a while, and I've heard someone say it. It might have been you, actually. You might have said this, or some other people who talk about these things, but someone floated the idea of countries around the world who are perhaps not stable, enlisting the help of Westerners to go and, you know, run those societies. Because when you think of Western society, you think, well, these people know how to build a civilization, you know. So why not enlist the help of these guys to help stabilize ours? And do you think that's a possibility in the future?
Yeah, I talked about this in my speech in Holland a few months ago, and it also came up in the previous Hangout with On the Offensive. I think it would be a good solution, because they would get what they want and we would get what we want. You know, we would get our own homelands back, our own countries back, and our peoples would be safe for the future. And meantime, they, meaning the black people, the Arabs and so on, the North Africans, they would have a stable society run, you know, kept in check, kept running by white people. And I think it would just be the best solution for everyone. I mean, it's like when the migrants, when they're fleeing a war zone, why don't we have places set up very close to where they already are that are run by us and that are safe and that they can go to? Why do they have to come to Europe? I mean, it's dangerous for them to come to Europe. And then, of course, it endangers us. It endangers our women and so on. It endangers our children in every way. So why do we do this? It would be far more sensible for, I think we should start floating this idea that we can requisition areas of their countries, or even do deals with their governments, that we will administer that country. And I think that would be the most equitable solution. The other thing, which is obviously lots of people in the alt-right, will say that we should just forget about them. We should just send them back, force them to go back and forget about them. And I understand that sentiment, but I don't think it's realistic. I think we are going to have to reach some kind of accommodation with them. And realistically, I don't think it would actually cost us that much economically, financially. And I think it would work, basically. That's what I think. I mean, here's the thing. I really don't want them to suffer. I don't want black people to live in the kind of deprivation and squalor and violence that tends to accompany black societies run by black people. You know, I don't want them to suffer that. Yeah. But in order to avoid that, they have to be in societies run by white people, or maybe East Asians. But I don't think East Asians would do it. So how do we do this? I mean, On the Offensive used the word neocolonialism or empire. I just see it as an accommodation that I think would work. And I put it this way, we need our own homelands back. And I think this is the best way to secure that. That's what I would say about it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to think about that a little more, to be honest, because it's something I have thought about in recent weeks. But in terms of the ideas of the alt-right in general, whether like we said earlier, I don't think a lot of people are going to line up and join the alt-right as it is now, but I think the ideas of the alt-right will filter down into the general populace. And in 10 years' time, I wouldn't be shocked to see some politicians rise up in Britain who are talking about this sort of stuff. Is that going to be too late? Maybe. But, I mean, the general public's always 15 years behind online conversation, isn't it?
I think it's never too late. I mean, people can be quite fatalistic about this. We are a very capable race, and we can deal with very shitty situations. And look at Germany after the war. It was rehabilitated very quickly. It got back up on its feet very quickly. All these cities that were completely decimated were rebuilt very quickly. The infrastructure recovered very quickly. So we can do this. And I'm not pessimistic about it, but so I don't think it's going to be too late. It's not going to be too late for, I think we've got a good few, several decades yet to make this change, this sort of what I would call a spiritual change. Mm-hmm. I think that you're right, that the ideas of the alt-right are going to start filtering through into the mainstream. This the establishment that we have just now are going to be outraged by that. But I think they'll gradually just come around to it because they'll realize, okay, the majority of the public are waiting for this change. They want this change.
I'm going to be watching it with great interest because, like we said at the very beginning of this stream, I'm still journey. I'm still figuring things out for myself. I'm watching so many people from all across the political spectrum on a multitude of issues. And I'm looking forward to seeing how this works out. My channel, I think it's a little weird. I haven't associated with any other YouTubers, really. I've done a few streams. Well, actually, I did a few streams with Rage After Storm when we both started our channels at the beginning of the year, which is quite interesting to see how that turned out. we both had like 5,000 subs or something. But in terms of the skeptics, I've never associated with them, never done any streams with them, never talked to them. So I think over the next year, I'm going to continue, living in my own little corner here on YouTube, but I'm going to be more open to talking to more people because, I'm trying to figure out what I think about everything. And maybe we should wrap this up now because I kind of have to go, but I just wanted to say, like, this has been a very interesting conversation for me to have, and I hope your audience has enjoyed it because it's really...
Oh, I think they have. Yeah, oh, good. I've been watching the live chat. I think they did enjoy it. Is there anything, because I was actually about to wrap it up anyway, I think this is a good point. Is there anything you'd like to say about your channel or the magazine that you're doing?
Oh, God, a plug. a couple of months ago, I started a magazine, and it's an actual physical magazine that you can hold it in your hands. There's a digital version, of course, but... the idea for that came about, I was seeing all these other YouTubers in our little circles, and some of them, without naming any names, they've got 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 subscribers. And I just thought, if I was in that position, I would have, not to big myself up, but I would have ventured out and done other things other than just YouTube, because that's an amazing platform to put your fingers in the pies. And it kind of offended me a little bit that a lot of them haven't done that. Obviously, something's going on now with, I don't really know what's going on with that Kilroy event. I haven't been keeping up, but has it gone tits up? I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm waiting for the dust to settle, and then I'll look into what the current situation is.
Yeah, and I know Sargon's started doing live shows and everything, but I thought, as someone, I really love old media. I love physical media. I used to love going to Blockbuster on a Friday night, and that was my entire Friday night. It was an event. It wasn't just flicking on Netflix and acquiring something as quickly as you can discard it, switching through films. It was a big event. You really valued media back then, and I wanted to kind of have something like that of my own and give a platform to people who watch me and people who are on the right and have a lot of things to say, but really don't have a platform to say them. Like they can't start YouTube channels for whatever reason. And we launched the first issue last month. It did very well. I'm preparing the second issue for March time, and we'll see how it goes. And it's very exciting. You guys can check it out. Under all my videos, I have a link to my site, and you guys can check it out if you haven't already. It's very exciting. I think more people in our position should start doing that. It doesn't matter what size channel you've got, I don't think. I think if you're willing to take the risk, I think it'd be very beneficial. It could be very beneficial for a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree. Well, okay, excellent. This has been a really good discussion. So thank you to Dan, the iconoclast. And thank you to everyone for listening. I think I've got another one in half an hour from now. And let me just see who that's with. I can't remember who it's with. Hold on. Westward Thought. That's a new guy. Okay, so thank
you. Can I just, can I just wish you a Merry Christmas and everyone in the chat Merry Christmas as well. Enjoy yourselves, guys, and I'll catch you.
Okay, Merry Christmas to you too, and thanks for coming on. Okay, I'll be back in about half an hour, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you then.